Welcome to the Kings and Queens podcast with your host, Johnny Langton. She led the only successful revolt in the 16th century, becoming the first anointed queen regnant. She had witnessed the decimation of the Catholic Church in England for her father's ultimate goal of siring a son. According to G.R. Elton, the vicious attack on her mother, her own bastardization, the treatment of her religion, ought to have turned Mary into a fearsome instrument of hatred and vengeance upon ascending the throne. But how merciful would she be? This is Mary the First. Mary was born on the 18th of February, 1516, in the Palace of Palencia, in Greenwich. Her father was Henry VIII, and her mother, Catherine of Aragon. It had been their fifth attempt at producing a child. She was baptised into the Catholic Church, and Henry's confidant Thomas Wolsey was her godfather, while her father, Henry, had been disappointed that Mary had not been born a boy. He doted on her. He took great pride in her, boasting to an envoy that this girl never cries. She would enjoy a very happy early childhood. Encouraged by her mother, Mary enjoyed a quality humanist education, studying Latin, French, Spanish, music and dance. She was a precocious child. She once entertained a French delegation with a harpsichord at the age of 4. She had a fair complexion, pale blue eyes, of low stature. She was very thin, with reddish hair, and had her father's ruddy cheeks. As she grew older, she was described as not just tolerably handsome, but had a beauty exceeding mediocrity. She was given her own court at Ludlow Castle, but while she was regularly called the Princess of Wales, the title for the heir, she was never officially invested, suggesting Henry was very much holding out for a son. However, his wife Catherine was having repeated miscarriages, and their once loving relationship was now one of bitter resentment. Catherine was approaching 40 and was unlikely to produce a male heir for Henry. This was a disaster. By the mid-1520s, Henry had set eyes on a young noblewoman at court called Anne Boleyn. Henry sought an annulment from his marriage to Catherine of Aragon with unyielding resolve. Catherine wrote to her nephew, the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, "My tribulations are so great, my life so disturbed by the plans daily invented to further the king's wicked intention. The surprises which the king gives me with certain persons of his council are so mortal, and my treatment is what God knows, that is enough to shorten 10 lives, much more mine." When he failed to get his annulment from Rome, he repudiated the Pope's authority, declaring himself the head of the new Church of England with the Act of Supremacy in 1534. Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, declared Henry's marriage to Catherine illegal and void, on the grounds that Catherine had consummated her marriage to Henry's brother Arthur before his death. She was stripped of her titles and styled as Dowager Princess of Wales, acknowledged as nothing more than Arthur's widow. Mary was therefore deemed illegitimate and was no longer the heir. She was styled Lady Mary instead of Princess. On the 25th of January 1533, Henry married Anne Boleyn. Mary's happy childhood had come to a devastating, abrupt end. In September the same year, Anne gave birth to Henry's child. Anne had said, "If she has a son, I know what will happen to Mary." But it was more disappointment for Henry, for it was another girl named Elizabeth. Nevertheless, Henry had a new heir. This was acknowledged with the Act of Succession. Elizabeth was officially made the heir, and Mary officially a bastard. Mary refused to acknowledge Anne as queen and Elizabeth as a princess. She was also banned from visiting her mother. It understandably meant strained relations between father and daughter, and they didn't speak for 3 years. From 1531, Mary became afflicted by irregular menstruation and depression. It would only get worse. While Mary saw Anne Boleyn as responsible for ruining her and her mother's lives, Anne, in return, saw Mary as a potent threat. If Mary acknowledged Anne as queen and Elizabeth as heir, her life would become immediately more bearable. Yet by nature she was stubborn and strong-willed, and saw compromise as nothing more than a sign of weakness. She lost her seat at the high table and ate with the servants. Anne then forced Mary to tend to her infant daughter Elizabeth at Hatfield House. Effectively under house arrest, she became increasingly isolated. She even thought Anne had tried to poison her when she fell seriously ill in 1535. When Mary's mother became gravely ill in the same year, Henry, still refusing to speak to Mary for her refusal to acknowledge him as head of the church or his new wife and daughter, continued to forbid her from seeing her mother. Mary would also have to endure the systematic dismantling of the Catholic Church. When Catherine died in January 1536, Henry and Anne were overwhelmed with joyful relief. A carnival-like celebration was held, with 2-year-old Elizabeth paraded like a trophy. Mary, on the other hand, who had been extremely close and loyal to her mother, whom she had been refused access for years, was inconsolable. Her request to attend her funeral was also refused. According to contemporary Ralph Morris, when Mary continued to refuse to acknowledge the changes set by Henry, it was Thomas Cranmer who persuaded the king not to execute his daughter. Henry said to Cranmer, "You may live to regret this." Less than 6 months after the death of Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn was beheaded on the orders of Henry. She had been accused of adultery. She had also failed to produce a healthy baby boy. Elizabeth II would now be declared illegitimate. Soon afterwards, Henry married his third wife, Jane Seymour, who helped bring the divided family together. Henry scolded Jane for defending Mary, claiming that she would be the enemy of our children. Mary was finally persuaded by the Spanish ambassador, Chappie, to submit to Henry's demands of acknowledgement. Mary reconciled with her father and was immediately invited back to court and ate at the high table once again. According to her ever-watchful cousin Charles V, Mary's treatment is improving. She never did enjoy such liberty as she does now. On the 12th of October 1537, Jane gave birth to a healthy baby boy, Edward. Henry was overwhelmed with joy. Mary was made Edward's godmother and enjoyed warm relations with her new half-brother. Unfortunately, the individual who had helped thaw relations between Mary and Henry, Jane Seymour, died just 11 days after giving birth. A devastated Mary acted as chief mourner at her funeral. During the years of Henry's marriages to Anne of Cleves and Catherine Howard, Mary once again slid into a pit of depression. She had bouts of illness onset by anxiety and troublesome menstruation. She described herself as the unhappiest woman in Christendom. But when Henry married his sixth and final wife, Catherine Parr, in July 1543, conditions would improve once more for Mary. At 27, Mary was just 4 years younger than the 31-year-old Catherine. They had many shared interests, despite their deep religious differences. Mary was an ardent Catholic. She had watched the continued destructiveness of the Reformation as shrines were smashed, holy days ignored, and monasteries dissolved. Yet in his final years, Henry was easing the pressure. The Reformation slowed, and he altered the line of succession to include Mary and Elizabeth once again, in 1544, to be second and third in line respectively behind their younger brother, Edward. 3 years later, on the 28th of January 1547, Henry VIII died and was succeeded by his nine-year-old son, Edward VI. Edward had been groomed a Protestant and was just as fervent as Mary in his religious affiliation. As he grew into a teenager, his once warm relationship with Mary soured as she continued to refuse to abandon the traditional Catholic liturgy. Under Edward's minority, Protestant councillors accelerated the Reformation. The whitewashing of stained glass windows continued, along with the destruction of statues and shrines. Cranmer released a new English prayer book that would be mandatory. Pressure was heaped onto Mary, who continued to attend Mass in her own home. By 1550, the pressure became so intense that plans were constructed to smuggle Mary out of the country, but it came to nothing. By 1553, Edward was dying. Along with the Duke of Northumberland, he made it his final mission to prevent Catholic Mary from ascending the throne. She would surely undo all the hard work of the Reformation. There were also concerns that she would marry a foreigner, putting the sovereignty of the realm at risk. In order to do this, they had to defy the provisions of Henry's will and divert the succession. In his dying days, Edward drafted his device to disinherit his sisters Mary and Elizabeth, and to name his reliably Protestant cousin, 15-year-old Lady Jane Grey, as his successor. When the sisters were summoned to Edward's bedside, they were wise to refuse. On the 6th of July 1553, Edward VI died. His death was kept a secret, in order for the Duke of Northumberland and the Grey family to mobilise. On the 8th of July, Mary was informed of Edward's death. The following day, she declared herself as Queen. On the 10th of July, Lady Jane Grey did the same, to a muted response in the capital. Soon afterwards, the court received a letter from Mary demanding her right to wear the crown. But Mary was seriously up against it. All major nobles, the army, and London were under control of Northumberland. He was president of the council, and had persuaded and intimidated his colleagues into supporting the new Protestant queen. His son had also married Jane, giving Northumberland a tight grip on power. Nevertheless, over the next few days, Mary rallied support in East Anglia. Huge numbers answered the call. Northumberland sought to capture Mary to consolidate the coup. On the 14th of July, he set off east. But rumours spread rapidly of Mary's swelling forces. Unease spread among the councillors. They heard of thousands of men mustering for Mary, yet they had just proclaimed Jane as queen. Northumberland's bloody, heinous quelling of Kett's rebellion in East Anglia a few years before had made him the most despised man in the country. Men were sent by their lords to fight for Northumberland, but they refused to go, and his army began to mutiny. Back in London, one of the councillors, the Earl of Pembroke, picked up his sword and shouted, "This blade shall make Mary queen, or I will lose my life." By the 18th of July, not one voice could be heard for Jane. The councillors, who had been locked in London for fear of defection, demanded the keys. Mary's victory was now inevitable. On the 19th of July, the council officially proclaimed Mary as queen. The bells rang out at St. Paul's, and Te Deum echoed through the city for the first time in 7 years, and bonfires were lit on all major crossroads. Northumberland had little choice but to lay down his arms. He claimed that Mary was a merciful woman and would declare a general pardon. His colleague replied, "You should have sought for mercy sooner." On the 3rd of August, Mary arrived alongside her sister Elizabeth to an overjoyed London. Households placed images of the Virgin in their windows as she passed. Northumberland had been half right. She would not order the execution of Jane, nor that of her family, who had conspired against her, not even Northumberland's son. Yet Northumberland himself was doomed. He egregiously denounced Protestantism, perhaps in an attempt to save his life, and commanded the public to follow the true way of Catholicism, before he was beheaded. Mary I's coronation on October 1, 1553 was a well-received event after the trials and tribulations of the attempt to place Lady Jane Grey on the throne. She quickly ensured that she was acknowledged by Parliament with a new statute as the first fully recognised Queen Regnant. This was crucial. The royal power of this realm is in the Queen's Majesty, fully and absolutely, as ever as it was in any of its noble progeniture kings of this realm. She inherited £185,000 in debt. She debased the coinage, revalued crown lands, and tightly controlled leasing policy. A new book of rates raised rates on average 100% and added a new duty on cloth exports. She also inherited a deeply fractious court. This was intensified upon the immediate release of Edward's enemies, the 80-year-old Duke of Norfolk, and an enemy of Thomas Cranmer, Stephen Gardiner, who was made Lord Chancellor. She sought advice from her cousin Charles V on how to rule. He advised her to return England to Rome and marry his son, Philip of Spain. At the time of her accession, she was 37, and time was running out to produce an heir, and to prevent her Protestant sister Elizabeth from succeeding her. In her early years, Henry VIII had attempted to utilise Mary as a diplomatic pawn. She had been hawked around Europe and offered to every prince from Portugal to Poland, though because she had been described as illegitimate, this proved difficult. Mary had begun to wonder if she would be forever a spinster. She said she had never felt that which is called love, nor harboured thoughts of voluptuousness. Yet upon seeing the portrait of Philip, she was besotted. Her arrangement of marriage to Philip met stiff opposition, and was generally unpopular across the country. It was thought that the marriage to Philip would jeopardise the Reformation, due to the presumption that Philip becoming king would make the English crown subservient to Europe's most powerful Catholic state, just like the Netherlands had become. This provoked the Wyatt Rebellion. As the rebellion provoked unease in the capital, the Queen gave a rousing speech to her citizens. Here she defined herself as a matriarch, comparing her role as Queen to a mother of the people. Just like in East Anglia, she rallied a force and defeated the rebellion. Lady Jane Grey's father had helped orchestrate the rebellion. In doing so, he forced Mary's hand. Though Jane was not thought to be involved, the rebellion proved that such a potential figurehead could not be kept alive. In February 1554, she was beheaded, along with her husband and her father. Mary had proven that her mercy only stretched so far. Her tolerance would weaken considerably. Another potential figurehead was detained, Elizabeth. Though not likely involved, Mary was suspicious and refused to speak to her sister. Philip wanted her executed. Mary wouldn't allow it, but she would be kept under tight surveillance. There were still serious concerns about the marriage. Mary refused to consider another match, declaring she had full right in sufficient years to discern a suitable partner in love. Yet she was not naive to the threat to her power. As the first proper Queen Regnant, the situation was unprecedented. Under common law, property and titles would be bestowed on the husband upon marriage. Queen Mary's Marriage Act passed in April 1554. Philip would be styled King of England, with all official documents signed by King, Queen, and Parliament until Mary's death. England would not be obliged to fund Philip's foreign wars, and he had no right to appoint foreigners in England without Mary's permission. This was not what Philip had anticipated. He was furious. His father, Charles V, would cede to him the crowns of Naples and Jerusalem in order for him to rank as high as Mary. It was clear that Philip did not share Mary's feelings. To him, the marriage was political and strategic. His aide said the marriage was concluded for no fleshly consideration, but in order to remedy the disorders of this kingdom. When Philip arrived to claim his bride, he spoke no English, and Mary no Spanish. Members of the Spanish entourage commented that the queen was not at all beautiful, rather flabby, with no eyebrows, and she dressed badly. They were married on the 25th of July, 1554. At the banquet, Mary used gold plates. Philip was given silver. His entourage was outraged. When the new couple were paraded through the streets, they were met with a muted response. Shortly afterwards, cartloads of Spanish gold rattled along the same route. Yet this wouldn't allay fears and suspicions of a Spanish takeover. At the time, the Spanish thought the English uncouth, vulgar, and drunkards, drinking whiskey until stark staring mad, like March hares. They were quick to take offense. They were white, pink, and quarrelsome, with fights and brawls erupting in streets and even in the halls of the palace. In September 1554, Mary stopped menstruating, gained weight, and became nauseous. She was thought to be pregnant. By April 1555, the birth of her first child was expected. The imprisoned Elizabeth was released so she could be present. Yet Philip was sceptical, and the delay bred a frenzy of gossip. The Venetian ambassador was also unconvinced, saying it will most likely end in wind rather than anything else. She continued to display symptoms until July, after which it was clear that it had been a false pregnancy. After which a resentful Philip departed, claiming he would not return until he was given a true role in governance. Mary was devastated. She considered the false pregnancy and Philip's departure as God's punishment for tolerating heretics in her realm. Mary's true legacy was about to be formed. Mary's ultimate goal was to return England to Rome. She immediately repealed Henry's Act of Supremacy, declaring that her mother and father's marriage had been legal, and abolished Edward's religious laws. This was met with stiff opposition, but was passed eventually by Parliament. When it came to Edward's burial, she said she did not want him committed to the ground like a dog, but reluctantly agreed to a reformed funeral, yet had a mass sung for him the night before. The anticipated Marian Counter-Reformation saw instructions for crucifixes to be recarved, the Virgin Mary displayed, rituals restored, masses sung, and holy days celebrated. Priests who had married under the Reformation were deprived of their benefices, amounting to a quarter of incumbents. After legal delays, in November 1554, England's obedience to Rome was confirmed. The son of the executed Margaret Pole, the man exiled under Henry VIII, returned to England as the papal legate. He was met with a warm embrace from Philip. When Reginald Pole spoke to Parliament, he said he had come to return the keys to the Kingdom of Heaven, on condition that all acts directed at the papacy were repealed. He absolved the whole realm and dominions from all heresy and schism, all judgment, censor, and pain. Many in attendance wept. Only two dissentient voices were heard. The tide had turned. Paul sought to restore the battered church. He sorted out finances and set up seminaries to train future priests. Palms were once again held aloft on Palm Sunday, the creeping of a cross returned on Good Friday, and the rite of resurrection performed on Easter Sunday. The Bishop of London decreed every church must have a cross for the dead, incense, a vessel of frankincense, and a Sanctus Bell. Only 7 out of the 22 Edwardian bishops returned to their sees. Yet the Counter-Reformation would be incomplete. Cults of saints, pilgrimages, the belief in purgatory and miracles remained casualties of Henrician and Edwardian propaganda. Edward the Confessor's shrine was one of the very few to be restored. Reginald Pole himself ordered an English translation of the New Testament. There was also the difficulty in reversing the significant upheaval in land ownership. After the dissolution of the monasteries, much of the land was taken by the state or auctioned off to the burgeoning merchant class. It was very profitable, and there was pressure from the council to leave them be. Who would want to surrender property that had now been held for decades? The monastery would never return to their former glory. With the country instructed to follow the Marian Counter-Reformation, what would Mary do with the men who had orchestrated the downfall of the Catholic Church? The men who would continue to speak out against her religion? How likely was the Queen to remain merciful in the face of the men who had caused her so much hardship? The answer came when she restored the heresy laws in November 1554. If Protestantism equated to heresy, it also equated to treason. She would use this as a tool to cleanse the land of the work of the devil. If condemned by the church, heretics would be handed over to civil authorities to be burned at the stake. It took just 3 months for the burnings to begin. As many as 800 Protestants fled the country in the wake of the Marian persecutions. The method was as follows. A stake or post would be fixed into the ground, with the ledge high enough to be visible to the crowd, where the condemned would stand. They would be fastened to the stake, but their arms left free. Wood and reeds would be piled on and set alight. Sometimes they would be damp, sometimes it would be windy, prolonging the agony. John Hooper, Bishop of Gloucester, was one of the first victims. The wood was damp. A bystander recorded his desperate attempts to engulf himself and end the misery. He smote his breast with his hands until one of his arms fell off. He continued knocking with the other, while the fat, water, and blood dropped out of his finger ends. He suffered for 45 minutes before dying as quietly as a child in his bed. But while there was anguish and fear, there was occasionally resolve. A doctor of divinity was seen dancing on his walk to the stake. "Why, Master Doctor, how do you now?" "Well, Master Sheriff, never better, for I am now almost home." Lord Chancellor Gardiner had hoped a few burnings would suffice and warn other heretics, but the reaction was steadfast and sympathy grew. Between 1554 and 1558, 283 Protestants were burned at the stake. They were mostly wage labourers. The gentry and clergy had mostly fled to Germany and Switzerland. Despite the growing religious strife that ran through every parish and community, and despite the reservations of her inner circle, including Chancellor Gardiner, Mary continued to authorise the burnings. She had yet to punish the sins of her most ardent adversaries. Almost immediately after her accession, she arrested Edward's most prominent bishops, Latimer, Ridley, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Cranmer. They were sent to Oxford and given a show trial. When Cranmer spoke, he was hissed at. On the 16th of October 1555, Latimer and Ridley were led to Broad Street, Oxford, where the stake was waiting for them. Cranmer was forced to watch. As they were tied on opposite sides of the stake, Latimer said to Ridley, "Play the man, Master Ridley. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England, as I trust shall never be put out." While Latimer's body mercifully went up in flames, Ridley was surrounded by damp wood. It was customary for members of the family to tie gunpowder around the necks of their loved ones to ease their passing. Yet the flames were not reaching. Eventually, it reached Ridley's neck and exploded as Cranmer watched on. It was now his turn. The man who had orchestrated Catherine of Aragon's downfall, the man who had declared Mary illegitimate, would meet his fate. 5 times Cranmer recanted his Protestantism, but Mary was not in a forgiving mood. She refused to grant him mercy. Cranmer was brought to St. Mary's Church in Oxford on the 21st of March 1556 to hear a sermon attacking him. He then gave a speech where he was expected to confirm his recantation. Instead, he dramatically reversed it, declaring the Pope as Christ's enemy and the Antichrist. He was dragged from his platform and led unceremoniously to the scaffold as the crowd erupted, the same spot where Ridley and Latimer had been put to flames 6 months before. As the flames licked his body, he put his hand in the fire, the hand with which he had signed the recantation. "This hand hath offended, this unworthy hand." There, Thomas Cranmer died. Reginald Pole became the Archbishop of Canterbury. Cranmer's death was a disaster for Mary. According to historian Jasper Ridley, as stories of a repudiation of his recantation spread, it became clear he had remained a Protestant. It also became clear that Mary had refused to absolve Cranmer, even though it was customary to do this upon her recantation. To Gardiner, the burnings were a deterrent. To Mary, it was God's will. This was nothing new. They had been used by Henry IV to persecute Lollards, but this was 150 years ago. The population had not seen them, and it was a novelty. The burnings usually took place on market days, in order to be viewed by as many people as possible. Supporters of heretics were also made to watch, but the refusal to recant Protestantism provoked sympathy from the public. Both Latimer and Ridley's deaths hit the public hard. They had been popular, and themselves sympathetic to the poor. Mary was creating martyrs. Yet the institution to which Mary was so desperate to unite England would become disillusioned with the English crown due to connections with Philip, just like the nation itself. Relations between Spain and Rome deteriorated. Philip was excommunicated, and in 1556, Reginald Pole was accused of heresy. Pole's legatine commission was revoked in April 1557. And he was reported to a papal inquisition as a suspected Lutheran. A replacement for Pole was sent to England, but Mary was willing to stand up for her archbishop and denied the replacement's entry, leaving England and Rome indefinitely at loggerheads. In the spring of 1557, Philip returned to England. There was one thing on his mind: war. The marriage of Mary, Queen of Scots, to the French Dauphin had resulted in Protestant riots north of the border. The English stationed 9,000 troops at Berwick in anticipation for Scottish movement. Mary agreed to join Spain in a war against the French. Yet the country was impoverished. A poor economic legacy left by Edward combined with exceedingly poor harvests and subsequent famine, left the country on its knees. The people were also resentful. The Spanish alliance had not resulted in English inclusion in Spain's lucrative trade in the New World. In fact, Spanish merchants actively guarded their trading routes. The war started well, with victory at the Battle of St. Quentin. But Mary ignored Philip's warnings of the impending invasion of English-held Calais. On New Year's Day 1558, 27,000 French troops entered the city. No reinforcements were sent. Calais was lost. 201 years after Edward III had triumphantly conquered the city. Though financially the loss was a blessing, losing the last remaining continental territory was a devastating blow to Mary's reputation. She reportedly said, "When I am dead and opened up, you shall find Calais engraved on my heart." With Philip's visit, Mary again thought she had fallen pregnant. In reality, the growth was likely stomach cancer. Mary swore she could feel the motions of a child, but despite the offerings of public prayers, no child came, leaving Mary in utter despair. She again thought it was God's punishment for failing to extirpate all the heretics in her realm. By May, despite there being few Protestants left to burn, she encouraged the bishops to show more speed and diligence. Meanwhile, a new epidemic spread. The new ague descended upon the citizens in early 1558. Mary became ill. This, combined with continuing poor harvests, meant public resentment grew. Any crowd in London was dispersed due to fears of revolt. Mary, it is said, was harassed by her mental anxieties more than the disease itself. By September 1558, it was clear the Queen was dying. A Venetian envoy commented that Mary was not of strong constitution, and of late suffers from headaches and serious affection of the heart. She is often obliged to take medicine, and is also blooded. With no possibility of producing an heir, Mary was finally resigned to the fact that the crown would pass to Elizabeth. She never forgave Elizabeth for her link to the supplanting of her mother all those years ago, but had always resisted calls to send her to the block. On the 6th of November 1558, Mary finally acknowledged Elizabeth as her successor. On the 17th of November, she died at St. James's Palace while attending Mass at the age of 42. Upon hearing the news, Philip said, "I feel a reasonable regret for her death." Just 12 hours later, Reginald Pole also died of the same illness that had stricken the Queen. Mary had wanted to be buried alongside her mother, but was instead interred at Westminster Abbey. As Thomas Cranmer burned, he reportedly threw a copy of the speech he made reversing his recantation of Protestantism to a man in the crowd. It would be published in the Book of Martyrs. By the 17th century, memories of the Protestant persecutions led to the sobriquet, Bloody Mary. She was compared to Jezebel in the 1558 book, First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. Yet in contrast, John Aylmer claimed that after Mary, it was not in England so dangerous a matter to have a woman ruler as men take it to be. As the first anointed queen regnant, she redefined royal ritual and law, establishing that a female leader could enjoy the powers of a king. But her marriage to Philip may have proven her biggest error, as Spain took France's place as England's most bitter enemy. But while she ensured Catholicism remained an identity in England, it became clear an anti-papal church practicing pre-Reformation doctrine was an impossibility. The Reformation would endure. Thank you for listening. Join us next time for Elizabeth I. You can follow us on Twitter at Kings Queens Pod and on Facebook, the Kings and Queens Podcast. You can also email in any questions that you have to thekingsandqueenspodcast@gmail.com. I will see you next time.